Good morning, everyone. The meeting of the House Special Committee on Fisheries will come to order, and the time is 10:03 on Thursday, February 19th, 2026. Members present are Representative Vance, Representative McCabe, Speaker Edgman, and myself, Chair Stutes. We have a quorum. We have a quorum. to conduct business. Please silence your cell phones, and we are asking that members of the audience not approach the table. If you want to pass a message to any member, if you would get a hold of my committee aide, Jane Pearson, she'd be delighted to help you out. I'd like to thank Andrew Magnuson, House Fisheries Committee Secretary. And from the Juneau LIO, we have Emily Mesh with our teleconferencing. Thank you, Emily. Today's meeting, we will be having a presentation from Jordan Head, Executive Director of the Bristol Bay Science and Research Institute, known as BBSRI. Welcome, Representative Kopp. On its in-season chum salmon assessment in the shoreside B-season Bering Sea pollock trawl fishery. Also, we'll be having our introductory hearing on HB 304, Sport Fishing Surcharge, by Representative McCabe. Mr. Head appeared before this committee last year. This presentation is an update on the work being done by BBSRI to produce timely information on the stock composition of chum salmon bycatch in the federal waters, providing a tool for the shoreside fleet that aids in the avoidance of Western Alaska chum. Welcome, Mr. Head. And I'm going to ask committee members if you would hold your questions until the end of the presentation, please. And with that, Mr. Head, I ask you to put yourself on record and begin your presentation.
Good morning, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Jordan Head. I'm the Executive Director of the Bristol Bay Science and Research Institute.
And I will take a moment to welcome Representative Hemshoot. Didn't I say you?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
yeah. Thank you. Please continue. Okay.
I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak with you this morning on some of BBSRI's initiatives, particularly providing an update on the in-season chum salmon genetics work that I presented to you on in May of last year.
And we have our last committee member, Mr. Elam. Thank you. Representative Elam, welcome. Thank you.
This project takes place in the federally regulated Bering Sea pollock trawl fishery, and there's been several important developments on this project, so I'm thankful for the opportunity to go over some of them with you today. Since I presented to you on this subject before, I'll try not to do just a replicate of that previous presentation and focus on new developments, but there's still some context that I think is important to go over again as we go through some of this today. As such, the first thing we'll discuss today is a brief background on the Bristol Bay Science and Research Institute and what we do. And then I'll take a moment to provide a little bit of context on chum salmon bycatch in the federally regulated Bering Sea pollock fishery and some of the challenges with focusing bycatch reduction efforts on Western Alaska specific chum salmon stocks. From there, I'll walk through the in-season genetics work conducted in 2024 and 2025, including results validation, several analytical advancements we tested in 2025, and how that project fit into the North Pacific Council's recent actions on chum salmon bycatch last week. I'll then briefly touch on a couple other BBSRI initiatives before we close. BBSRI is a 501c3 research institute, which was established in 1998 as a subsidiary of the Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation, one of the six CDQ groups. We're governed by a seven-member board made up of watershed community leaders in the Bristol Bay region. And for more than 25 years, we've worked closely with resource managers, fishing sectors, municipalities, and communities to improve fisheries science and management in Bristol Bay with the ultimate goal of sustainability of the region's fish and game resources. We do this by focusing on filling gaps in existing management structures, by developing science-based tools and working with agencies and industry to integrate those tools into the greater management structure. When it comes to this chum salmon bycatch assessment project, it got started because across western Alaska, chum salmon declines in the late 2010s and in the early 2020s led to subsistence closures and significant hardships for rural communities. During that same time period, the federally managed Bering Sea pollock fishery experienced years of high chum salmon bycatch, which raised concerns about its impact on western Alaska stocks. Here we have a figure showing chum salmon bycatch in the pollock fishery from 2011 through 2025. However, western Alaska chum salmon are a relatively small proportion of the chum that are taken as bycatch in this fishery, so it's important to understand what chum stocks are taken in that fishery as bycatch. NOAA has been sampling chum salmon bycatch in the Bering Sea since 2011, and their postseason reporting gives us a good understanding of what stocks of chum salmon are being caught. This map shows the approximate groupings of chum salmon stocks that we find as bycatch in the Bering Sea trawl fishery, according to NOAA. From 2011 through 2023, the largest contributor to chum bycatch in the Bering Sea were of Asian origin, averaging 52% of the bycatch annually. These Asian stocks can further be split out to Southeast Asian, which are hatchery fish from Japan, and Northeast Asian, which are Russian chum salmon, of which there is a large hatchery component. The Eastern Gulf of Alaska Pacific Northwest reporting group is also a large contributor. This is a rather large reporting group that incorporates chum stocks from Kodiak, Prince William Sound, Southeast Alaska, British Columbia, and the Lower 48. This group made up about 27% on average of the bycatch, and this stock reporting group is also largely made up of hatchery production. Coastal Western Alaska chum are all wild stocks and have made up 19% of the bycatch on average from 2011 through 2023. However, it's been highly variable over that time period, being as low as 9% in 2020 to as high as 25% in 2016. So when we overlay the Western Alaska chum bycatch on our total chum bycatch figure here in orange, we see that the Western Alaska stocks are not the dominant stocks, and therefore these large fluctuations in bycatch were primarily driven by non-Western Alaska, predominantly hatchery stocks. So when we think of focusing bycatch reduction efforts on Western Alaska chum, there's several challenges associated with that effort. The first, as we just spoke about, is the proportion of Western Alaska chum in the bycatch is highly variable from year to year, ranging from less than 10% to more than 20% in others. And historically, the genetics information that can help tease this apart has only been available 8 to 10 months after the fishery ends, limiting its usefulness for in-season decision making. And as a result, in-season avoidance measures up to this point have only looked at reducing total chum salmon catch, not Western Alaska chum salmon catch. However, we also know that simply reducing total chum bycatch doesn't necessarily reduce Western Alaska chum encounters. A clear example of this comes from 2021 to 2022. In 2021, the total chum bycatch was about 550,000 chum salmon, with Western Alaska stocks making up roughly 10% of that catch, or about 51,000 Western Alaska chum. In 2022, the total chum bycatch was reduced by more than 50% to about 250,000 chum salmon, but Western Alaska stocks made up 23% of the bycatch in that year, resulting in a higher actual Western Alaska take than the year before. This illustrates why in-season stock-specific information matters, because just reducing total chum catch by 50% does not necessarily reduce bycatch of Western Alaska chum by 50%, or in this example, even reduce it at all. So in 2024, we began this project as a feasibility effort with a simple question. Can we produce accurate genetic stock composition information for the shoreside sector of the Bering Sea pollock fishery fast enough to matter while the fishery is still underway? There are three sectors in the Bering Sea pollock fishery. There's the catcher-processor sector, the mothership sector, and the shoreside sector. We focused on the shoreside sector in this study for two reasons. First, because of the three sectors in the Bering Sea pollock fishery, this sector is the largest contributor to chum salmon bycatch and Western Alaska specific chum salmon bycatch. So this is where the largest impacts could be made. And secondly, because it's logistically the most feasible. By placing port samplers in each of the plants accepting deliveries and having a centrally located lab, we could quickly and efficiently sample the genotype of the catch. In 2024, the answer to our question was yes. We can produce these estimates accurately and quickly enough to be meaningful. And in 2025, we went fully operational with the project and reported the results publicly on our website and through an email distribution list that anyone can sign up for. There was two goals of the project in 2025. First, to do that weekly assessment and do it and report it publicly. But the second goal was to work on developing a tool for the shoreside fleet that could actually aid in the avoidance of Western Alaska chum salmon bycatch, which we'll talk about a little bit here in just a moment. I don't want to go into methods because they're boring anyways. But the there's three things that are essentially needed. First is port sampling. In order to produce these estimates on a weekly basis, we need to sample at a much higher rate than NOAA currently samples. And in both 2024 and 2025, we were able to staff and sample all of the plants accepting deliveries at these increased levels. The second is the genotyping work itself. This is the lab work. To speed this up, we had to first build a lab in Dutch Harbor, and then we had to work on developing lab protocols and procedures that would allow us to operate both quickly and accurately. In 2024, we did extensive QA/QC, and the results from our lab were both independently verified by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game and by NOAA. And the last is the actual stock composition estimates themselves, the analysis step. This is where we take the genetic makeup of each fish as produced in the lab, and we come up with the proportions of where they are from. This step was conducted by NOAA in both 2024 and 2025, and will continue to be done by them going into the future. All right, that's all with methods. So when it comes to the 2024 project results, we didn't release anything publicly during the season. And the reason for that was we wanted to assure the accuracy of the estimates. And this required comparing those results directly with NOAA's postseason results. The figure on the top is the in-season totals from BBSRI's project, and the figure on the bottom in red is NOAA's postseason results. Both estimates were extremely similar. Both estimates showed a very similar pattern across stocks, and when we aggregated all the Western Alaska stocks together, we get very similar answers of about 14 to 15% of the bycatch being made up of Western Alaska chum salmon in 2024. One important thing to note here is that the in-season genetics don't replace NOAA's program. Rather, they complement them by providing temporal and spatial resolution while the fishery is actually occurring. These projects have very different objectives. As a result, NOAA does fixed sampling, which is important for overall assessment of proportions, whereas BBSRI's sampling is variable, which is very useful for generating weekly, more frequent mixture analysis. Turning to 2025, we saw an overall reduction in the proportion of Western Alaska chum in the shoreside bycatch, averaging about 6.4% over the course of the season. That's notably lower than in 2024. However, it's important to keep proportion and volume in context. A lower percentage does not necessarily mean a lower catch. That really depends on what the total chum catch is that year. NOAA's estimates are still being finalized, but as in 2024, our in-season estimates will be directly compared to them, and we expect them to match. All right, now to the more fun stuff. As we begin looking at the weekly results, I just want to make you aware, I'm not going to walk through each of these figures in detail for time's sake. The figure on the left shows the weekly stock composition proportions of chum bycatch for each of the stocks. And the figure on the right shows the corresponding weekly catch numbers for each stock reporting group. So looking specifically at the figure on the right in the dark and light blue, we can see the actual numbers of Western Alaska and Yukon chum salmon caught each week. While I've been describing results, while I'll describe results largely in terms of proportions, it's important to emphasize this project also allows us to translate those proportions directly into weekly catch estimates of Western Alaska chum salmon. In other words, this framework allows us to track not just what fraction of the bycatch is Western Alaska, but how many of the chum that are caught are Western Alaska. And that matters because it moves us from being a descriptive exercise to one that can actually support in-season awareness of the cumulative Western Alaska impacts and promote accountability, rather than just solely relying on the postseason estimates. And this was crucial to the council's actions last week, and we'll get there here in just a minute. This figure illustrates what we traditionally get out of the postseason analysis by NOAA, a single season-wide stock composition estimate. So for example, the figure on the top left shows in 2025, coastal Western Alaska chum made up approximately 5.2% of the bycatch on average over the course of the season. When we overlay the results of the in-season project, we can really start to see the value. We can see how Western Alaska proportions fluctuate over the course of the season. So in 2025, looking at the figure on the top left, we can see Western Alaska proportions were relatively higher during the first half of the season and lower during the second half. And that pattern is completely invisible when you do season average numbers. And that weekly variability is what creates management utility. As managers and industries attempt to minimize Western Alaska encounters, knowing when proportions are elevated allows for targeted awareness and avoidance during those specific time periods, rather than applying these broad measures across the entire season. In short, this moves stock composition data from being descriptive after the fact to informative while decisions are actually being made. Up to this point, I focused on what we've been producing through the standard weekly public releases in 2024 and 2025. After the feasibility year in 2024, we wanted to test whether we could provide additional utility for in-season management, specifically whether the same genetics framework could be adapted to better understand where and when Western Alaska chum are being encountered. And in 2025, we tested two additional analytical approaches to explore that. The first advancement was producing stock composition estimates by fishing grounds. This map highlights different fishing grounds that are commonly used in the pollock fleet, such as Unimak Pass in blue, the Shelf and the Shelf Edge in the kind of brownish and dark yellow, and the Privilofs in pink. When we had sufficient samples within statistical weeks, we started generating area-specific stock composition estimates. This allowed managers to see whether the composition of chum bycatch differed spatially across the fishing grounds, including whether Western Alaska proportions were higher or lower in different areas that week. That spatial resolution supports more targeted understanding of risk, rather than treating the entire fishing grounds as the same. The second advancement in 2025 is what we refer to as lightning strike analysis. These are rapid, targeted genetic analyses of individual deliveries associated with high chum salmon bycatch events. The goal here was not routine reporting, but adaptability, to provide information quickly enough to inform decisions while conditions are still unfolding on the fishing grounds. Statistical week 38 from 2025 is a clear example of how these things can work in practice, and I kind of want to use that as a case study real quick for you, a quick one. In order to get a full picture of that statistical week, it's important to understand what the conditions were leading up to it. Through statistical week 36, total chum bycatch to that point in the season was around 25,000 fish, and about 3,500 of those were made up of Western Alaska and Yukon stocks. The Western Alaska and Yukon stocks had been averaging about 14% of the bycatch to that point in the season. Statistical week 38 stands out because it was a sudden, concentrated increase in total chum bycatch, rather than a more gradual shift. And to understand why, I think it's important to actually show you what was happening spatially on the fishing grounds during that week. Leading up to Statweek 38. Most of the fishing effort was concentrated in an area that is referred to as the horseshoe, shown here on the map. That area was producing very good pollock catches, but herring bycatch was becoming a growing concern. And the fishing effort was being pushed into an increasingly smaller area of good, clean fishing. As vessels actively looked to avoid herring and some of the congestion they were experiencing, some began exploring the area called the Northwest Edge, seen here on the map. This movement was a bycatch avoidance response to conditions in the core fishing area regarding herring. And when vessels encountered pollock on the Northwest Edge, they ran into very high chum salmon bycatch, which triggered immediate concerns across the fleet. Here's a timeline of how things shook out that week, and I won't read this, but on September 12th, BBSRI was notified by the inter-co-op managers that fishing on the Northwest Edge had encountered unusually high chum bycatch. And the first deliveries from that area began offloading in Dutch Harbor on September 14th. In the morning of September 15th, we got a request from Sea State, who does the kind of the in-season management in this fleet, that requested rapid genetic analysis of the first two vessel deliveries coming out of this area, so they could get an understanding of what chum salmon stocks were being caught in this increased bycatch event. Samples were collected immediately, genotyped in Dutch Harbor, and within 48 hours, we had genetic results available. What they showed was that the bycatch on the Northwest Edge was dominated by non-Western Alaska stocks, comprising roughly 98% of the fish analyzed. And Western Alaska stocks were a relatively small component at 1.4% of one of the vessels and 2.6% on the other vessel. Having this information in real time allowed managers to evaluate the event based on Western Alaska chum salmon, not necessarily just the total number of chum salmon caught, and respond accordingly. In 2025, this project demonstrated that in-season genetic stock composition estimates can be produced reliably, publicly, and fast enough to matter. We've known since 2024 that the project can track the actual number of Western Alaska fish being caught while the fishery is occurring. And most importantly, we proved in 2025 that the project can support adaptive in-season avoidance decisions. The Statweek 38 is a good example of how this information can be obtained quickly enough to make actual informed decisions during the season. So, 3 years ago, the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council began a formal process to examine ways to reduce the pollock fisheries' impact on Western Alaska chum salmon stocks. Very early in that process, the idea of a Western Alaska-specific chum salmon cap was considered because it was well understood by the council, as we discussed earlier in this presentation, that simply reducing total chum bycatch doesn't necessarily reduce Western Alaska chum bycatch. However, that idea was rejected early on as infeasible. The data was not available to be able to do that. The reasoning was straightforward. There was no reliable way to distinguish Western Alaska chum from other chum during the season. And without that accountability mechanism, you cannot manage to a stock-specific limit. Over the past 2 years, this project has demonstrated that near real-time stock identification is not only possible, but operationally reliable. And last week, I presented these, what I presented to you to this point today, to the council while they were considering their final action on chum bycatch. And with that analytical confidence in place, the council adopted a Western Alaska specific chum salmon cap with mandatory in-season corridor closures if that limit is met or exceeded. Importantly, the motionly explicitly incorporated in-season genetic monitoring. In other words, the project helped move the concept of a stock-specific cap from theoretical to operational. With the council's final action, incorporating in-season genetics into the management, our focus now shifts to operational sustainability. Over the past 2 years, BBSRI has built the personnel capacity, laboratory infrastructure, and field sampling systems necessary to operate this program at scale. Funding for the 2026 bee season has been secured through the CDQ sector, and we've also secured a $3.5 million federal grant through Senator Murkowski's office to support the program from 2027 through 2030. Importantly, this means that the state's earlier investments in this project were catalytic. It allowed us to build and validate this tool, and that success has now leveraged long-term funding to sustain it. We're also in discussions with partners about how this framework could be adopted to additional Bering Sea pollock sectors in the near future. Before we move on, I want to thank this committee for your letter of support last spring to the congressional delegation. That support was instrumental in helping secure this federal funding for continuing this project. The Chum Salmon Project is one example of how collaborative applied science strengthens fisheries management. Another example of that model in practice is the Bristol Bay Fisheries Collaborative, if you'll indulge me for just 2 minutes. In 2017, following several years of state budget reductions, ADF&G's core Bristol Bay assessment program was operating at a significant deficit. Rather than allowing continued erosion of management capacity, BBSRI and ADF&G entered into a formal MOU establishing the Bristol Bay Fisheries Collaborative. Under that agreement, a joint technical working group defines what is necessary to maintain a world-class fisheries management system within Bristol Bay. And then stakeholders work with BBSRI to help close that funding gap for those priority projects. From 2017 through 2021, stakeholders raised approximately $750,000 annually to maintain key infrastructure, including counting towers, sonar operations, the Port Muller test fishery, and biologist trainee positions. Over 9 years, approximately $5 million has been contributed towards sustaining core fisheries assessment in the Bristol Bay region. And while much of that state funding has since been restored, the collaborative remains active, with stakeholders currently contributing roughly $400,000 annually to operate the Port Muller test fishery, a crucial piece in the management structure. This model has helped preserve the scientific foundation of Bristol Bay fisheries management during fiscally constrained times. And as Bristol Bay's sockeye assessment program has stabilized, the next major priority in the region is strengthening our understanding of Chinook salmon. In 2022, Nooshigak River Chinook salmon were designated as a stock of management concern. And that designation made clear that while sockeye monitoring in Bristol Bay is world-class, Chinook assessment represents the next critical gap. Rather than pursuing isolated projects, BBSRI and ADF&G have worked together to develop a multi-year research framework focused on building durable, sustainable assessment capacity. And over the past 3 years, we've implemented harvest monitoring improvements, escapement weirs, aerial survey work, and foundational data collection necessary to support planned abundance estimates and run reconstruction efforts. The goal over the next several years is to transition from this targeted capacity building into a comprehensive Chinook assessment framework that includes independent abundance estimates, biological monitoring, and improved run reconstruction tools. And as the core sockeye monitoring program has stabilized, there's growing interest among stakeholders in strengthening this next phase of Chinook assessment work. As we've seen with the Chum Genetics and the Bristol Bay Fisheries Collaborative, building durable management system requires structured planning and aligned partnerships. I'll close with this. Strong fisheries depend on strong science, and durable management systems are built through partnerships. As we've shown through the Chum Salmon Bycatch Project and through the Bristol Bay Fisheries Collaborative, and what we're currently building with Chinook Assessment in Bristol Bay, is that when agencies have aligned technical partners, management capacity expands. Collaboration allows us to move faster, test ideas, and maintain accountability, all while keeping management authority where it belongs. And when science, management, and stakeholders are aligned, Alaska's fisheries are at their strongest. Thank you, and I'm available for questions.
Thank you. I have a couple questions, and then I see Representative McCabe has a couple questions. Thank you. Thank you. Very interesting. Very interesting. I have a couple questions, and one of them is on slide 5 and 6. You present the regional composition of chum salmon by catching the Bering Sea pollock trawl fishery. How does that Western Alaska chum bycatch fishery compare with the statewide bycatch of Western Alaska chum?
That's an interesting question, Madam Chair. I am not exactly sure on that. There, and what we consider bycatch versus, you know, directed fisheries. So I don't, that would be something I'd have to probably do some compiling to get that information and bring it back to you at some point. I'm sorry.
Oh, that would be great if you have the opportunity to do that. I'd sure appreciate it. And then are you aware of any other place in the world that has this kind of ability to do in-season genetic testing like it's being done here for management?
Yes, Madam Chair. So in-season genetics is not necessarily a new tool, but I think it's starting to be applied to different scenarios. In 2021-2022, we collaborated with the Department of Fish and Game's Gene Conservation Lab to spearhead on the Port Muller test fishery a mobile at-sea genetics lab. And we put a lab on one of the Port Muller test fish research vessels to be able to do these genetic analyses very quickly where we're actually catching the fish. And we were able to get results every other day to give a preview of what sockeye are returning to Bristol Bay and what rivers they're going to. But in-season genetics, that wasn't the first instance of in-season genetics. In fact, the Department of Fish and Game was doing that in the Anchorage lab prior to that. And I know that the Department of Fish and Game has several other in-season genetics projects that they operate throughout the year in different fisheries. But what I think we're starting to see is it become more mobile. I was at a genetics conference. I don't remember. This has been a long winter. I was in a genetics conference earlier, I think last year, and that similar technology that kind of ADF&G and BBSRI spearheaded was adopted, I believe, on the Columbia River in Washington, where they now have a kind of mobile genetics lab in the back of a van, and they take those to different areas on the Columbia to do in-season genetics and look at things. So this is progressing. And you're starting to see more examples of it outside of Alaska, but it's been pretty common in Alaska for a while. We're just starting to adopt it, and I think it's becoming more public knowledge at this point.
So it sounds like this could possibly become a model for monitoring bycatch in other fisheries.
Yeah, Madam Chair, as far as I believe – like this chum salmon project was really modeled after the success of the Port Muller test fishery. But anytime you develop the project to answer the question you're trying to answer. So specifically picking up this exact what we're doing here and dropping it somewhere else might not work. But you look at the logistics of the fishery, how the question you're trying to answer, and you develop a project that can answer that question. The model being trying to perform, you know, genetic analysis rapidly. It could be used in a model in other fisheries, but it would be specific to, you know, the fishery itself, not just picking up the exact framework and dropping it somewhere else.
Appreciate that. We'll go to Representative McCabe.
Thanks, Madam Chair. So actually, this is very encouraging. You know, I've been saying for years that we needed to start focusing on the resource and less on the stakeholders, and this is a really good step. One question I kind of have, and you've sort of answered it, but how close are we to doing it real time on the vessel instead of just a mobile lab kind of moving around? Is there any chance that that would ever come to fruition?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe. I mean, it is possible to do on vessels right now. We do it on the Port Mueller test fish vessel, where we have a lab and a Connex, and we run genetic samples every other day to get kind of real-time results, and typically have results within 24 hours of the fish being caught. Now, it's mostly about the use case, right? I'll take the Bering Sea pollock fishery, for example, and the catcher processor fleet. There's been discussion on, like, couldn't we put a lab on each of these catcher processor vessels and do this? And it's more about, you know, how many, like, the cost of doing that versus the data that's going to come out of it. So there are scenarios where that might be very applicable. But right now, like, the cost of running one of these labs is pretty high. So putting multiple of them everywhere, right now it makes more sense to have a centrally located one close by that you can get the samples to. Now, there has been, I have heard over the last couple of years, a lot of, you know, kind of speculation on, you know, handheld devices and test strips, things of that nature that are developing right now. My understanding is some of these handheld devices and test strips, when we're looking at determining stock of origin of a chum salmon or a salmon, right now we use SNPs, and it requires about 86 to 96 SNPs to identify the stock of origin of that fish. Right now, from my understanding, these handheld devices and test strips are capable of looking at like 1 to 2. So if you can imagine doing one chum salmon in this scenario, you would require 86 different test strips, and then you'd have to input the data of each of those. So it might become feasible in the future. I don't know an exact timeline for something like that to happen.
Thanks. I appreciate that. And follow up, if you don't mind.
Of course, Representative McCabe.
I mean, what I'm really interested in is, frankly, the Asian hatchery fish. I mean, I think we ought to put a bounty on them and bring them all to shore and donate them to our food, yeah, because they're just competing with Wild Alaska for the feed grounds. You did say one thing that was very, very interesting to me, and it sort of plays into the next presentation we'll have. When you said that data is important, science is important to managing fisheries. I really appreciate what you guys have been doing. Not really a question, more of a, but this is really interesting. Actually, this should be, your whole presentation should be public. For many reasons.
Is available on BASIS.
Right?
I totally agree.
It's encouraging.
It's very enlightening. Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Jordan. Jordan, you were talking about this whole presentation is basically done from one of the three sectors, right? The shoreside sector is all we're really talking about here. Mm-hmm. So the genotype, all the sampling, when we say 52% of the chum bycatch are of Asian origin, that's all we really are talking about is the shoreside sector. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Kopp. No, like this figure right here on slide 5, this represents chum bycatch in the Bering Sea pollock trawl fishery, all sectors.
All sectors,
yeah.
Okay.
Right now, our study is focused on the shoreside sector because, one, it was probably the easiest to get started, and that's where the majority of the three sector, or I guess there's technically four. There's the catcher processor sector, the mothership sector, the CDQ sector, and then the shoreside sector. The catcher processors being the larger vessels that catch and process on board. Mm-hmm. They fish much farther to the north. I always get east and west wrong when I'm thinking about northwest. Mm-hmm. And so they're typically closer up towards Russia. Their composition typically is a much higher percentage of Asian fish, and they typically catch a very low percentage Western Alaska origin because they fish farther out to the northwest. The mothership sector kind of fishes more spread throughout. These are catcher vessels that deliver to a floating processor, and so they kind of move around throughout the fishery. That's a relatively smaller sector by quota and bycatch and Western Alaska specific bycatch. And then you have the shoreside sector, which are catcher vessels, which deliver to shore-based plants. And as a result, they can't economically fish farther offshore like the other two sectors. So typically, they make up the of the three sectors, they make up the largest percentage of chum bycatch overall. And then since they're closer to shore, they make up a higher – typically their catch is comprised of more – a higher proportion of Western Alaska fish than the other sectors. And so that's why we focused on the shoreside sector for right now. But with the council action last week, there is, a lot of conversation about how we can incorporate those other sectors into this project as well.
Follow up, Representative Kopp.
Thank you. Jordan, so everything we're talking about is on our side of the international dateline. Do we know what the chum bycatch is on the other side of the international dateline, or any idea?
Through the chair, Representative Kopp, I think that from my understanding, I'm definitely not the expert on this, but from what I've heard is we get very little to no data coming out of what bycatch numbers are in the Russian fleet operating on the other side of the dateline.
So all we can do is just extrapolate. Maybe they don't catch bycatch.
No comment.
Maybe we can keep our fish on our side. Yeah.
Maybe winter's over. So, Mr. Head, to follow up on Representative Kopp, do you have any idea of what the percentage of trawl caught chum in the Bering Sea trawl fishery are compared to the total chum catch in Western Alaska?
I think I know what you're asking, Madam Chair. So in the EIS that looked at the during council that looked at what the impact rate of the pollock trawl bycatch was on Western Alaska stocks, I believe it was in the low single digit percentage on what the impact they were having on that stock was. But that's all available in the EIS that was put out by the council as part of this process of looking at chum bycatch. So I'd have to pull up, I could go and look and pull the exact numbers, but I believe it was very low when you're looking at what the of all the impacts on these stocks, what the pollock fishery was causing. It was pretty low, in the low single digits as far as a percentage.
If impact. You have an opportunity to do that and provide it to my office so I could forward it on to the committee members, I'd be real appreciative of that.
Yeah, and through the chair, if there's any questions about, the council action or any of the analysis, council staff is very accommodating to answering questions as well.
Appreciate that. Yeah. Representative Himshute.
Thank you, Chair Stutz, and through the chair. I think I just want to look at slide 20 for a second, and I want to make sure I understand what you were saying, that so a couple of vessels, so it's hard for me to understand the scale of what's happening out there. I'm from Southeast, and so I have a pretty good sense of who's doing what down here. But you said some vessels went out to the northwest edge, and then 2 days later, they made it back to Dutch, to where the lab is, and you were able to. I'm just thinking how much fishing could be going on in those 2 days, right? Like that's incredibly fast.
Yeah.
But you still have vessels out there, and if everybody else was moving from the Horseshoe area, I don't know the scale of that. Is that 100 vessels? Is it 20 vessels? So if they're all moving up to this northwest edge, and then and 2 days later you get, you do the processing at your facility in Dutch, that's 2 days of fishing that have continued. So what kind of effort would be involved there?
Absolutely. Through the chair, Representative Himshute. So when we talk about this fishery, this is a very long fishery. We're talking about 4 months from early June, and this year it went all the way through the end of October. And so a lot of times when we think about salmon fisheries, we're thinking, Bristol Bay fishery, it's a 6 week fishery. So it's happening quick. So yes, there is some, as you can see here on slide 22, during stat week 38, 12 vessels went out to this area, and they ended up catching 36,000 chum. Of those chum, about 800 of them were Western Alaska origin. And we are able to get this information fairly quickly. how this fishery typically works is it's really on a week-to-week basis. Each Tuesday, Thursday, they announce closure areas. The organization Sea State will put in these rolling hotspot closures. They do that every Thursday. And so how this fishery operates, it really is on a week-to-week basis on that response and adaptability because it's such a long, you know, four-month season. But what happens in the interim is, from my understanding, all of these vessels are constantly communicating with each other, and they have real good data sharing agreements in place. And so this was kind of an unusual event. I can't speak for the industry. I'm really kind of an outside observer doing science, but I have gotten to know kind of how it operates over the last couple of years. Typically, you know, this was kind of an unusual case in which they were running into herring trouble. There was a lot of congestion. Several vessels at a similar time frame went out to normally that's they're staggering a little more. And so, yes, it's not perfect. And several fish can be caught in that time frame. Typically, though, you know, if a vessel is fishing in an area and runs into, you know, a lot of chum like that, that immediately goes out and people will start to avoid that area and we can figure out what was being caught there before vessels go back out, is how I think this will start being incorporated in the future. Also, we're very early in, we're in year two of having this information and getting it out there and seeing how it's responded to. So it's still very early.
Thank you. Follow up?
Yeah. Thank you, through the chair. And then I'm starting to learn about eDNA, and it's really exciting, but it feels a whole lot like magic. Like, it's really hard to think. So could it come down to just water samples and presence and absence of fish by the species? So I'm thinking of it for invasives, right? The green crabs are marching right up through Southeast. And I'm thinking, with eDNA, we could know that they're here or they're not here, right? So presence or absence. Can that work in the chum fishery as well? I'm sorry, in the trawl fishery with the chum bycatch?
Through the chair, Representative Hemshoot. That's a really intriguing question, and I think you're making some really good connections here. I know that in some of their surveys, there's a lot of eDNA work that does go on in a lot of the NOAA surveys. We've been looking at, as part of this kind of Chinook assessment program in Bristol Bay, how can we use eDNA as getting some sort of abundance estimate on some of these rivers that are harder to assess. That's an area of genetics, an area of science that's rapidly evolving. But I will say I'm definitely not up to speed on all the research there. So I do know there's some exciting things happening. I don't know about how it could be used in that sort of use case, but I know there's people working on things like that right now.
Okay, quick follow-up.
Quick follow-up.
Thank you, through the chair. So if eDNA became something that we had confidence in and we thought it could work, is your lab adaptable to that technology quickly?
Through the chair, absolutely. Yeah, that's the part of the beauty of when I was talking about, you know, aligned technical partners. I worked for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game for 10 years, and what I see the beauty of working for this organization now is we can pivot extremely quickly, hire people quickly, get equipment, new equipment quickly. So if that was something that showed a lot of promise, and that looked like the way we needed to go, yeah, we can quickly pivot and develop that capacity in the lab. And we do have, you know, the NOAA Okbe lab, who does a lot of that eDNA work, as very close collaborators on this project. If there's potential there, we could move that direction very quickly.
But we need it in real time. Like, you can't.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Elam.
Thank you. Appreciate the presentation. A lot of really good information, and it's kind of spurred on a couple of thoughts for me. How does we hear a lot about trawl and bycatch. How does this data, like, which lane specifically is it? Kind of, it seems more narrow than the overall bycatch conversation. And so I'm just wondering if you can kind of help me understand where this data lays in that particular lane.
Yeah, through the chair. So this all takes place in the federally managed federal waters in the Bering Sea pollock fishery. So it doesn't have to do with any of, you know, the state waters fisheries or, you know, the Gulf of Alaska fisheries. It's all taking place there. And that's primarily because that's where, you know, when, you know, 3 years ago when we were looking at Western Alaska declines and the Bering Sea pollock fishery, which is happening just offshore of Western, you know, Western Alaska and the Bering Sea, that was looked at in the chum bycatch in that fishery. And what we do is we try to come in and help build these science-based tools to help solve problems in fisheries. And so that was revolving around the council action they were looking to make in that fishery. But we're just talking the Bering Sea pollock sector right here.
Okay. Follow-up, please.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Representative Elam.
On slide 25, through the chair, thank you. I see kind of like the funding sources and that there was some state investment. And again, this is really good information and everything. And so help me, you know, I'm kind of wondering where your funding kind of partners with, and does the state still provide any support, or was it just kind of the initial startup costs?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Elam. Initially, a $990,000 direct legislative grant was given to BBSRI to get this project up and off the ground. That helped do all the project development in 2023, procuring equipment. It got through the entire feasibility year of 2024, and then it got us through about halfway through the 2025 operational year. And then last year during session, the legislature re-upped for another $500,000 direct legislative grant to get through the entire 2025 operational year. In the meantime, Senator Murkowski's office had put in a CDS request in FY25, which no budget ever got passed for, and then it was just passed in this last budget cycle last month. And so that, knowing that that was likely to pass, we had to go seek kind of bridge funding. And the state had already invested, you know, $1.5 million. The project had been proven that it works. And the CDQ sector actually approached us and said, hey, like, we would like to provide bridge funding for this so that it can get you through to when federal funding sources kick in.
Okay.
Yeah.
And one last little follow-up, please.
Certainly, Representative Beam.
Thank you. Do you guys have any kind of legislative priorities or anything that we're working towards? Is this presentation kind of focused on any particular legislative type issues?
Through the chair, Representative Elam. No, this was I'm here today to update you on the investment you made and let you know how this project has worked out. I believe in accountability. When you are given funding, you're accountable to let people know how that went. And so I'm really thankful to be able to report to you guys on that today. But no, there's no specific legislation or ask. It's an informative decision reporting back to you on the funding that you provided us.
Wonderful. I appreciate the information. It was a great presentation. So thank you.
Yep.
Thank you. Representative Edgman.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Jordan, really appreciate the presentation. I think I might be, other than you, the only other person in the room that's actually been at the lab and been able to sort of see it in action. We tried to make
it headed out there.
We got weathered out with a testy, but we tried to get out there. And I would urge all members of the committee to take the opportunity to go out and take a look at the lab itself, get to talk to the people that are out there. And, you know, it's just fascinating to know that in year two of a really nascent effort, and, you know, my perspective, of course, is informed by what you're doing up in Bristol Bay and Port Moeller and the salmon fisheries and how it's really become a very effective in-season management tool. But that in year two, you've already been able to affect some major action at the North Pacific Fishery Management Council. And you just sit here and, be really encouraged by what this could be in a few years, you know, in terms of its applicability to other sectors beyond just the four plants in the Dutch. But maybe if you could talk just a little bit about your staff, and you know, you've got some pretty qualified individuals down there. You know, the 4-year horizon that the $3.5 million grant through Sarah Murkowski gives you, right? Operational money, as I understand it. But can you just, for the committee's understanding, put that into perspective on what that, you know, means to a program? Again, to highlight it, you're in year two. You're just coming out of the gate.
Yes, through the chair. Speaker Edgman.
Yeah.
I lost the word. Yeah, I really appreciate that question, because a lot of times I end up at these meetings giving presentations, and the reality is I do very little. there is a whole team of people who actually operate this project, from Abby Duffy, who we hired on as the lab manager, who spends 6 months a year in Dutch Harbor operating this project, to Jason Smith, who's the project manager, who in 2024, within, you know, 3-4 months, had got all this equipment, going and visiting each of these plants and figuring out all of the logistics that it takes to make this happen, and getting calls at 2-3 in the morning that vessels are coming in to deliver and we need to get staff over there. And you know, the 6 technicians that are in the plants 24 hours a day in Dutch Harbor and Accutan, living at the plants and sample and catch. And then also the NOAA Observer Program, because this project would be exorbitantly more expensive without the Observer Program, because they do all the inspections of offloads, compile all the chum, and then deliver them to our, you know, our observers. So there's, that takes a lot of the effort off. Additionally, you have people like Dr. Pat Berry and Dr. Wes Larson in NOAA's Auk Bay lab right up the street, who meet with us on a monthly basis over the last 3 years, as we collaborate very closely with them, and Bob Foy at NIMS, or NOAA, the head of the Alaska Science Center. And so it's a huge team effort, and all of them need to be recognized, as well as, you know, Commissioner Doug Vincent Lang, who in 2024 directed staff to do whatever they could to assist us with this project, and everybody at the Gene Conservation Lab at ADF&G there in Anchorage, who, you know, from connecting us with vendors to be able to get supplies to, you know, it is a huge team effort. And that team effort will continue over the next 5 years as we work to see if we can incorporate other sectors into this, and expand staffing to be able to do this more quickly and efficiently.
If I could just really quickly interrupt.
Certainly.
Just a quick shout out to the commissioner for making sure that the $500,000 that was in the budget last year did not get vetoed. Yes. That bridge funding was as critical as we can now see.
Just along those lines, let me just add, clearly this is a success story, you know, and it shows what collaboration can do between your organization, fishing organizations, native organizations, the state, the feds. It's wonderful to see, and I hope that this legislature has an opportunity to perpetuate and promote situations like this, because this kind of project is nothing short of a win-win situation. The user groups win, the resource is a winner. I mean, it's really delightful. Representative McCabe.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Yeah, Jordan, thanks for being here, for highlighting this. I think oftentimes, you know, those citizens that are concerned don't see the behind the scenes things that happen. Even we don't see the recognize necessarily the money that we put in the budget for you, and that the commissioner and the governor let pass through and make sure we have this valuable program going on. And I think that it's important that we be better, others be better at passing this along. So hopefully the 54,000 members of a certain Facebook page are watching, and they will see this presentation and and understand that the legislature and Doug Vincent Lang and the governor and NOAA and you and everybody involved is not doing nothing. We are actually trying to do something, and I appreciate the presentation.
I think it's incredibly important what you just said, Representative McCabe. Having the science to back your comments, your statements, your ideas makes all the difference. And this is a perfect example of it. So, Jordan, I'm sure I can speak for this whole committee. We really appreciate you coming, giving us an update. We look forward to the next update, and we thank you for your time.
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
And with that, we will move on to our next order of business, which is House Bill 304, sports. Sure. Welcome, Representative McCabe, and your staff help, Ms. Almeida. We're happy to have you here. If you would introduce yourself for the records and proceed with your presentation for House Bill 304.
Thanks. Good morning, Madam Chair and Vice Chair Edgman and members of the committee again. For the record, I'm Representative Kevin McCabe. I represent House District 30. With me today is my staff, Elisheva Almeida. I appreciate the opportunity to present House Bill 304, a bill focused on ensuring Alaska has reliable economic information to support one of our most important resource industries. As we heard in the last presentation, the science and the data is critically important for us and for the department to make management decisions on our fisheries. Alaska's sport fishing industry is a cornerstone of our state's economy. It supports thousands of jobs, generates millions in state and local revenue, and brings visitors from around the world, directly benefiting communities across Alaska. The last statewide sports fish economic impact report was produced in 2007, nearly 20 years ago. That data, which we critically need to make good decisions, whether business decisions or resource management decisions, is now outdated and insufficient for making informed decisions about the access and allocation, conservation and infrastructure. It's a problem we can't ignore. Currently, we are managing one of Alaska's most important renewable resources using 20-year-old data, and there's no funding to collect or analyze updated information. HB 304 is vital because better current data benefits everyone. HB 304 requires the Commissioner of Fish and Game to produce and publicly release a biennial report on economic impacts of sport fishing following the methodology of the 2007 report to maintain consistency, credibility, and transparency. So HB 304 works like this. The bill establishes a $1 sport fishing angler access surcharge on sport fishing licenses to fund the report without using UGF. The revenue goes into an allocated subaccount within the Fish and Game Fund and remains fully subjective to legislative appropriation and oversight. A sunset date of January 1st, 2032 allows the legislature us to review the program's effectiveness after just two reports and decide then whether or not to continue it. I think the committee should support HB 304 because Alaska cannot continue managing one of its most important natural resources using two-decade-old data. In short, we have to know what we don't know. HB 305 provides reliable, up-to-date economic information that directly benefits fishermen, communities, and the state's economy. The $1 surcharge funds this work responsibly, reinvesting directly into sport fishing programs without burdening the general fund. The bill has broad support from Department and Fish and Game and many, including many other organizations, including Southeast Guides Association and other associations in South Central. This reflects a thoughtful and well-vetted solution. In closing, Madam Chair, HB 304 ensures Alaska sport fishing industry is managed with accurate data, transparency, and long-term planning. I'm happy to answer any questions. My staff, Elisheva Almeida, is going to read an overview with your permission of the sectional at this time, and then we are open for questions.
Wonderful. Thank you. Ms. Almeida?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Elisheva Almeida, staffed Representative Kevin McCabe. The sectional overview for House Bill 304 is as follows. Sections 1 and 2 adds legislative intent and requires the Commissioner of the Department of Fish and Game to produce and publish a report on the economic impacts of sport fishing in Alaska. Section 3 creates the Sport Fishing Angler Access subaccount within the Fish and Game Fund to receive revenue from the new surcharge and support the report. Sections 4 and 5 update statutes related to reciprocal sport fishing license agreements with Yukon Canada, first adding reference to the surcharge and later removing the reference to align with the sunset provisions in the bill. Section 6 amends the state statute to establish a $1 sport fishing angler access surcharge on sport fishing licenses with exemptions for certain reduced fee or free licenses. Section 7 repeals the surcharge, the reporting requirement, and the funding account effective January 1st, 2032. Sections 8 and 9 authorize the commissioner to adopt necessary regulations, and sections 10 and 11 outline the sunset effective date and the general effective date. This brings the sectional review to a close.
Do we have any questions from this committee?
Sure.
Representative Kopp.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative McCabe, for bringing this forward. Do you think it's possible that we could ask the state's lead economist or one of them at the workforce development? You know, they give us their monthly trends magazine, and they always look at the different sectors and what they're doing as far as economic activity in the state to look at the sport fishing industry specifically. Would that be another way we could kind of get at this admirable goal you're pursuing here?
And through the chair, Representative Kopp, sure. I think that's entirely possible. I don't know that they are equipped to gather the data and go to places like this, the previous study did, but possibly. Certainly they could in fact, it would probably be in collaboration with any study that we are authorizing right now, where they could take that data and expound on it and make it part of their reporting. I would, that would be fabulous. I mean, they do that for the commercial fishing industry as well. So, yeah, I'd be really interested in that. And I think also, Madam Chair, if you don't mind, Mr. Feckel is here from Fish and Game, and I think the commissioner, I hope, is online, and they could maybe tell you a little bit about how they envision putting that data into the Trends magazine. Or
you are correct, and thank you for that. I should have mentioned that Joe Feckel is indeed here, as well as Commissioner Doug Vincent Lang is online. Did you hear the question, Commissioner?
Yes, I did, Madam Chair. My line just got unmuted. So what we would do if this surcharge got passed is we would, this money would go into a sub-account. We'd form a sub-account in the Fish and Game Fund and deposit that, the proceeds from the sale of the surcharge, into that. And then when we had enough money in there to conduct a statewide survey, which we expect to be somewhere between 3 to 5, maybe 1 to 3 years out, we would then contract out a survey to estimate the value of sport fishing, and I'm presuming anything that requires a sport fishing license, like personal use fisheries across the state, and then publish a report. We would do that through a contractor. In the past, those contractors, we put it out to bid, and we put out the specifications of what we want to see the outcomes of that contract being providing to us. We would help them with data, but it would be up to the contractor to write that report. And this would be very similar to the type of report we did, I think it was about 8 years ago, that we had last survey we did out there, and we would, again, publish that report and help the contractor get that data done.
Thank you.
And one other thing, if I could add, Madam Chair, is that the department will often inform the Board of Fisheries regarding the value of fisheries, because it's really the Board of Fisheries' responsibility and authority to evaluate, when they're making allocative decisions, the impact of economic considerations. And right now they have a lot of that information from ASME studies on the commercial side. And I think what this study is trying to do is, or this attempt is trying to do, is to get information that's more updated on the recreational fisheries and the personal use fisheries that the board can then consider in making their determinations. And of course, we would make that information available to the board as part of their deliberative process once it's updated.
Thank you. Representative McCabe, I notice that Section 3 provides for the fishing angler access account. However, the dollar fee, there's no funds allocated to that access account. How do you perceive that angler access would be funded?
So, Madam Chair, if you don't mind, I think that's probably, we had a conversation with Joe Feckel this morning about that. He's probably a better person to ask that.
Certainly. Mr. Feckel, could you come forward, please?
Madam Chair,
for
clarification, we're working on version I. Is that correct?
Yes.
Thank you.
For the record, Joe Feckel, I'm the legislative liaison for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Through the chair, my understanding is the question is, what aspect of the bill is related to angler access? Is that the question?
No, Mr. Feckel, the question is, how is angler access going to be funded when it appears that this bill is directing the dollar fee strictly towards the report?
Yes, thank you for the clarification. To the chair, so in my talks with the bill sponsor, Representative McCabe, that's just some leftover language from a prior bill that was introduced by the governor. There was an angler access surcharge in which the representative had put forward an amendment for this economic study. And so my understanding is, through drafting with legislative legal, they used that bill as a model for this one. So this current version of the bill doesn't have any relation to angler access. It is just the economic study. So that's just some lingering verbiage from prior versions of a similar bill.
Oh, I must be looking at the wrong one then. Thank you.
Madam Chair, if you don't mind. So
certainly
we would have to take that out. I mean, we would find an amendment. We found it this morning. We were looking at it and going through the bill this morning. So either
so your intent is to remove it?
Either a committee substitute or to make that so the fishing act, the angler access language was removed. I didn't catch it, and we will certainly provide an amendment on the floor. Why are you laughing?
No worries. No worries. Representative Elam.
New revenue bill.
Thank you. I appreciate the dialogue. My question was originally directed for Representative McCabe, and so I was just hoping this particular conversation is actually something that a lot of folks in my district are pretty interested in. When we talk about economic development, Cape Head is one of my economic study groups. They rely on a lot of this kind of resources and information. Have you reached out to any of those folks to see what kind of interest they may have in some of this information?
So through the chair, if you don't mind, Representative Elam, sir, yes, not recently, not. So if you remember the genesis of this bill, I put in an amendment, I think, on the floor and to another bill, and everybody said, no, we want our bill to go through clean, put in your own bill. So I did. But 2 years ago, when we were in the majority, when we were sort of managing the fisheries committee, we did have two hearings on a very similar bill, I believe, that just didn't make it through for one reason or another. In fact, I think we tabled it right towards the end. But in the process of that, we did all of that investigation with, I don't know if it was specific to KPED, but yes.
Follow up, please.
Follow up.
Yeah, it's been a conversation that has come around, and you know, the MATSU also has kind of their fish study that the borough does there. We've always been kind of jealous about that on the Kenai Peninsula, but the economic impacts and being able to get that data specific to the what sport fisheries bring in, it impacts so much of the economy. So, just thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you. I appreciate Thank you. It.
Representative Speaker Edgemond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe this question is best served to the commissioner, but I'm trying to contextualize all this in relation to the commercial fishing industry and the economic analysis that comes out of there. And I guess my second point would be what role the Department of Labor plays in all this. I don't see it listed in the bill. Because the Department of Labor would ultimately be part of the dissemination of the biennial report, perhaps not directly, but they would be a downstream agency working with the Department of Fish Game, at least in theory. But if the commissioner or Mr. Feckel could sort of elaborate on that.
Commissioner Vincent Lang, did you hear the question?
We would be working. Okay, sorry, my line was muted again. Through the chair, I did hear the question. What we would do is we would hire a contractor once we had sufficient funds to put a contract out. And you're right, Representative Edgemond, we would have to work with other state agencies. And I presume if there's a cost associated with that participation, we would be helping fund their data gathering that would be necessary to fill the contract moving forward. So we would have to have sufficient resources in the fund, which we expect right now, I think, would take 2 to 3 years to get that sufficient resources to do a statewide objective. But we would help our sister agencies make sure that the contractor we hired had the available data to get it done. And I think the model that's being presented here is very similar to the ASME model. The ASME model is basically an assessment on fishermen, basically, and then ASME uses that to do the commercial value of commercial fisheries, and I think this is a model after that where the responsibility to pay for it is borne on the shoulders of the people getting fishing licenses, and then they would then contribute to getting an economic survey for their fisheries. And again, that information would be provided to the Board of Fish to make regulatory decisions that the Board is required to consider economic impacts on.
Madam Chair, a follow-up. I'm certainly supportive of the concept. I think it makes sense. And just a couple other questions, again, to help sort of put all this in perspective. The bill talks about a biennial report. Why would that not ultimately be an annual report? And then, again, the question about what the comp side does in terms of getting this information. Is there any type of a similar assessment?
Through the chair, I think there is some value in having a biennial versus annual survey, just because, you know, typically I think most of these economic firms think every once 4 or 5 years is sufficient. But at the same time, I'm not necessarily opposed when we have the funding available in this surcharge to do it more frequently than once every 5 years. So I like the concept of something between 2 and 5 years. I don't know if I would be married to every requirement of every 2 years, because sometimes that data is not going to be updated sufficiently in a two year time frame. So the committee might want to consider, you know, allowing some flexibility in terms of the time frame based on when it's necessary, rather than stipulate 2 years. The second question you had is, I think it related to how is ASME currently doing this, Representative Edgemond?
Through the chair, no, the commercial fisheries side of things in the department.
Was it with CFEC or?
Through the chair, I presume it would be through CFEC, but what's the corollary or what's the, you know, what do we do on the comm fish side that would be equivalent to this?
Okay. I understand it now. So through the chair, what they basically do is they hire, they have economists. I think they also hire somebody else to go out and do the work. And they basically do a very type of similar thing. They're mining data from a variety of different sources to come up with the economic value of these fisheries. And, you know, mostly the contractor is responsible for that mining of the data. And in some cases, they go to the Department of Labor. Some cases, they go to the processor. Some cases, they go to the fishermen. You know, it's, but basically, it's their responsibility to do that. And I think as we kind of coordinate that, but I'm not sure. I think we'd have to get back to you as to what role ASME does versus what role their contractors do in providing the final survey result.
And thank you, Madam Chair. That's fair enough. I just wanted some kind of a comparison and jog my memory because I hadn't thought about it for a while.
Yeah, through the chair, if this might help, with the Pacific Salmon Treaty, we just wanted to get a value of treaty fisheries for the United States so that we could talk to Congress about the value of those fisheries. And we just basically hired a contractor to do that work, which is Southwick. And it's going to be their responsibility to go and mine that data from a wide variety of sources. We set what we wanted as the expectation and product out of it. But, you know, as a secretary, we've agreed to help them get the data, but it's really their responsibility to mine that data and perform the analysis.
Just one of the quick comments, since I'm in such a helpful mode here. it might be useful down the way to just take out the biennial. So you have a report. You can do it in the regulations every year, every 2 years, whatever you want. But I also wonder on the line 13, page 1, if it might be helpful to make that socioeconomic, not just economic, if that would give the department a little bit more flexibility to broaden the report if need be. So, two extremely helpful tidbits.
Thank you, Representative Edgman.
Through the chair, I don't quite know how to respond to that. No, I'm totally open to my objective, Speaker Edgman, is simply to get the data into our hands. Mm-hmm. I think that, as again, any time we saw it earlier with the presentation from Jordan, anytime you don't have the data, you're sort of operating in a vacuum. So we need to know what we don't know. And if we can get the data in hand, then whether it be the Board of Fish or the Commissioner or even the CAPED is making economic decisions or making decisions or we're making allocative decisions, I think it's important to have the data. So as long as we start down the path of getting data, to me that would be acceptable. So I'm looking forward to your amendment, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you. Well, if we do this, yes. Representative Himshut.
Thank you, Chair Stutz. It's probably already pretty much been answered because I had the same question about biennium, but my question is to the commissioner through the chair. You said 1 to 4 years, and then you said 2 to 3 years. What does a study like this cost, and how much would a dollar fee bring in? And I know we'll be getting a fiscal note, but as far as whether it's every 2 years or every 5 years, and maybe we don't need to drill down on that, but your number of years that it would take to get to the first study had some variability to it. So what would it take to get the first study done?
I think that Mr. Feckel may have a response for you.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Himshut, I will field that one for the commissioner. I prepared our fiscal note. In terms of the timing, you know, one thing to look at is the ASME economic report on commercial fisheries comes out every 2 to 3 years. In speaking with the prior contractor that did the 2007 study that the department produced, they last time we reached out to them in 2024 when Representative McCabe's amendment was put forward on the governor's angler access surcharge bill, they had recommended 5 years. So there is some, you know, argument to be made for anywhere between, you know, 2 to 5 years or even annually. So it kind of depends on the information, but some amount of time is helpful in looking at changes in trends. If a report every year may not show much difference from year to year, but a report every 2 to 3 years would show some changes in those trends. As far as the costs, based on our analysis, looking at the number of licenses sold over the last 5 years, we anticipate a $1 surcharge to generate around $465,000 in revenue annually. And the anticipated costs for producing a study like this, we anticipate to be around $350,000 in services costs to contract the work and about $75,000 in personal services costs to the department for our staff to coordinate that, help provide data, and work with the contractors to put the study together.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Are there further questions from this committee? Representative Vance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have questions for the commissioner, and I'm just trying to get an understanding of what's going to be included in this, because the commissioner mentioned the personal use. So this talks about sport fishing, but the commissioner, you mentioned personal use. So who's going to, what fisheries, who's going to be included in this survey?
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Vance, if I could. What I said is we're trying to figure this out right now because it's the value of sport fishing, but you require a sport fishing license to participate in PU. So we're trying to be more comprehensive than less comprehensive in determining what the value of sport fishing is. And trying to figure out whether that's just a sport fishery per se or something that requires a sport fishing license. We're open to hearing what your suggestions are moving forward. But from my perspective, if we can be more encompassing rather than less encompassing, that would be beneficial. Number two is I just want to make it clear that we may end up with money. We don't know for sure. This is all kind of what we're doing in terms of talking to people what the estimated cost of these surveys are going to be and how frequently they need to be done. But the concept here is that we would not use money that's in this subaccount for anything other than economic surveys. So if you go to maybe once every 3 or 4 years rather than once every an annual or once every twice a year, depending on what we're hearing back from the contractors, we would have the ability potentially to use some of this money to dwell down into some more specific fisheries on a case-by-case basis that maybe inform some board decisions on the annual cycle. So we, for instance, we might be able to just look at the value of some personal use fisheries in certain areas or the value of a fishery in Prince William Sound if that's needed to inform the board.
Follow up.
But we would not spend the money surcharge without, unless it was tied to the economic evaluation of sport fisheries.
Thank you, Commissioner. The next question was the type. I know that ASME uses McKinley Research, at least in the past few years, and they have specific tonnage. You can talk about the economic value per for the landings, and there's concrete data that is used. And you mentioned surveying fishermen, and I'm feeling like we're missing data. I've had constituents reach out to me that they'd like to see us bring back the freshwater logbook program, and then the issues of the Southeast with the ghost boats. We don't know how much is being taken. So what data do you see will be gathered to give a true economic picture that is tied to the resource specific to this report?
Yeah, Representative Vance, through the chair, we would probably start with the last contract that we had out there to look at statewide economic values of sport fishing as a starting point. And then we would look to that as a foundation to finding out whether we wanted to have additional questions asked. But at a minimum, we would try to make it as comparable to that one, since that one was the foundation and baseline to which we'd be comparing moving forward. So a lot of it's going to be up to the contractor, but at the end of the day, it's how we write that bid that goes out to the contractors as to what we want moving forward. And you're right, there's a lot of unanswered questions. Some of that questions that may require the contractor to do some work on serving different groups of people to fill in those data gaps. We simply don't know. That's why I'm very uncommittal to saying whether we're going to do this in the first year we have $350,000 in this sub-account, because we really don't know what our contract is going to look like at this point in time until we have some preliminary discussions with contractors and and with people that are interested in what the output of these surveys will be.
One more follow-up for the
certainly Representative bill sponsor. Vance.
And this is just a technical question. I'm seeing the $1 surcharge in section. It's there. I saw it. But is this an increase in the cost of the sport fishing license, or is this just saying that a dollar of the current cost of a license will be used specific to this? Because I'm used to seeing more dollar figures in our drafting, and just wondering what the style is here.
So through the chair, Representative Vance, this would be an increase, a $1 increase to both the resident and non-resident licenses, with the exceptions, I think, that Mr. Feckel said. I think there's the low income, and what was the other one? Was the senior.
Disabilities also.
Disabilities, yeah. So with those exceptions, yes, it would be an increase by $1. Real similar, if you remember, to the hatchery, I believe, increase we had several years ago that was used to help establish and to fund some of our hatcheries. So that's my answer.
Thank you for that clarification. Just in the drafting, I'm used to seeing where they list all of the dollar amounts and was wondering if I had missed something.
Oh, so thank you. Appreciate that. Seeing no other questions from this committee, thank you, Representative McCabe and Ms. Almeida, and of course, Mr. Feckel and Commissioner. Thank you for your time today. And with that, we will set House Bill 304 aside and address the issues that have come up. We're still working on next week's schedule. We will send out an email with what's going to be on next week's schedule as soon as we have it all finalized. If there are no further comments from this committee, we have no further business, so we will adjourn at 11:35.